The head of California's Office of Emergency Services joins us with an update on disaster recovery efforts in Butte County following the Camp wildfire. In this week's Cap Chat segment, the surprise cliffhanger in the Central Valley, where a race originally called for the Republican incumbent, now looks like it may go to the Democratic challenger. The Sacramento region is evenly split over whether to build new housing. We'll delve into the revealing findings of a new survey by Valley Vision. And Cap Radio's Hey Listen host Nick Bruner wants to remind us there are still two more days before holiday music is considered acceptable. That's our sound advice segment for the week. I'm Randall White in for Beth Ruyak today. That's on Insight. First, here's the news. From Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Randall White in today for Beth Ruyak. Today marks 3 weeks since the explosive start of the Camp wildfire in Butte County. And to date, officials have identified at least 88 people who lost their lives in that fire, with nearly 200 people still unaccounted for. It is by far the deadliest wildfire in California's history. Roughly 14,000 residences were destroyed, leaving thousands homeless. Joining us today is Mark Ghilarducci. He's the director of Cal OES, the agency tasked with coordinating the disaster recovery efforts. Mark, welcome to Insight.
Good morning.
And your office is managing the efforts, but you are partnering with FEMA, correct?
We are partnering with FEMA. Once the president declared this a major disaster declaration at the federal level, then FEMA came in and has been working side by side with us.
And it's not like there's just one trouble spot to be concerned with. What does your priorities list look like, and what's at the top?
Well, you know, right now we're still focusing on dealing with supporting the disaster survivors who were able to evacuate. Many of them are still in shelters. We're trying to work diligently to get them into transitional housing, whether it be in the hotel rooms or into rental properties. So one of our big priorities right now is housing. As well, we're continuing to support the search operations that are still underway. That is making sure that we can account for any additional fatalities, and that's hopefully going to be coming to an end soon, but it still is an active operation, and we're making sure that we can buy down the people who have been reported still unaccounted for and you know, continuing to search up in that area. And then we're in the process of beginning the overall effort of how are we going to deal with just a massive amount of debris that has been left. You have, in essence, the town of Paradise, which has essentially been destroyed. And, you know, between commercial and public buildings and individual residences, we're close to about 18,000 structures in Paradise and then in the surrounding communities. So it's a big effort there, and we're in the process of working closely to be able to deal with that as well.
The rains, of course, were welcomed. How have they complicated your efforts?
Well, I mean, it makes it a lot more, you know, sort of miserable in that sense of being up there and doing the search operations. We've had to mobilize very rapidly to put in mitigation efforts to minimize mud flows or debris flows that may occur as a result of the rains, clear out some sort of basins and these kind of things. So there's been a big effort. It slowed a little bit of our process because the winds that came with the rain started to bring down trees that had been damaged by the fire but had not come down, and that became a major safety issue. And so we had to work in and around those areas. We had to go in and remove some of those trees a little faster than we thought. So, you know, the rains are, you know, flash flooding and the potential for all of that is here. And in essence, it's sort of rolling from fire to flood. We're, and we just are, We are just reacting and proactively reacting to the new situation.
Mark, in terms of housing, I know that FEMA now is offering, some roughly 2,000 trailers that evacuees can use. I imagine those are mostly short-term housing option. What is your biggest challenge when it comes to accommodating everyone that needs a warm, dry place to stay?
Well, it's a great question. You know, what we want people to do who have been impacted by the disaster is, of course, call in and register on the FEMA disaster line and get into the system. People who qualify, who are eligible, you know, we want to get them out of a shelter. We will, you know, our first line of defense is really kind of getting them into either a hotel solution or into a rental property. Rental property is the best way to do that because, you know, there's really nothing better than getting into a home and you know, kind of starting to get your life reorganized again. Problem is that rental properties are, you know, either they've been consumed now completely in the Butte area, or they were limited in the first place and requires us to go a little bit further out in surrounding counties. That means that people may have to, you know, end up having to travel back into work. And so our focus is trying to keep as many people who live in Butte County in Butte County. If there's no rentals available or we've exceeded what people are willing to do, even if they're willing to go outside of the area a little bit, the next step that we look to is trying to find a place where we could put in either travel trailers or fifth wheels for those individuals who that works for, and some that does. If not, then we will actually go in and place in a what's called an MHU, a manufactured housing unit. It's a mobile home in essence, and those typically take a little bit more to get on the ground because you have to have, you know, obviously sewer and water and all of the wraparound to be able to do that. And so that's more of like a 60-day solution. And so we've been actively working to identify locations in the Butte County area where we could put in some mobile home parks, I guess you could say, so that we could have a number of people get into those. And you know, what we're doing, we're in that process right now of trying to identify those families who are interested in that solution. But we're not waiting to actually go in. We know we're going to need that solution. And so we're in the process of also getting the land, securing the land. And we've been staging a number of those units, both at McClellan and then also up in the Ford area, in a staging area that we have in Butte County, in anticipation of actually getting them put on the ground.
There are the daily activities that we often take for granted when we're not in a situation like the evacuees of the Camp Wildfire. You know, those include, you know, going to the dentist or just taking our daily prescription and those sorts of things. How do you deal with health concerns, mental health concerns, prescriptions, all those sorts of aspects?
Yeah, another great question. So this is really a massive operation. It's coordinated all through the state operations center here in Mather in Sacramento at OES headquarters, and we're working very very closely with Butte County, or so many different state and federal agencies that work to address what the needs are. So what happens is the needs, whether it's pharmacy support or if it's some sort of a medical item or commodity comes up, and we identify what that need is, and then we fulfill the need. It could be fulfilled through the ability of state agencies or departments. It could be fulfilled through turning to our federal counterparts at FEMA, and they tap into a federal system of resources to be able to fulfill that need. It could be our Office of Non-Governmental and Philanthropic, where we go to the private sector and the private sector partners with us to fill the need. Or we may just go in and contract to be able to meet that need. But in the forward area, we have actually placed in, you know, medical facilities. We've got our pharmacists, doctors, medical teams from Department of public health and our Health and Human Services Agency, our Emergency Medical Services Authority, and then federal HHS. They're all in theater working on those issues. But it ultimately all identifies from the field what the needs are, whether it's at a shelter or it's at another location, and that comes up through the State Operations Center. It's coordinated, and it's rapidly turned back around to fill the need.
We are hearing from the Governor's Office of Emergency Services Director, Mark Ghilarducci, about where recovery efforts now stand as we hit the three-week mark since the start of that deadly and destructive camp wildfire in Butte County. And I'm curious, Mark, has Cal OES ever dealt with a disaster of this scale?
Well, the answer is yes. I mean, we've had, you know, obviously the Northridge earthquake and we had the Loma Prieta earthquake in recent time. But from the standpoint of a fire and the number of losses of single family residences, or in this case, actually losing an entire town, is a first for us. And so we've had to, you know, whether it's fortunate or unfortunate, we're coming fresh out of the 2017 fires, where, you know, large portions of Sonoma, Santa Rosa, Mendocino, Lake and Napa counties all had massive losses. And we, you know, that there's a lot of different operational constructs and processes that we follow that we just move from, because we're still managing. In fact, just before the fire that took place in Butte, as you probably remember, we had the car fire up in Shasta, in Redding, where we had that fire tornado that was so dramatic, and then the Mendocino complex that burned for days. We've been very much engaged in this nonstop for the last couple of years, and really we're just sort of rolling into this one. But I will tell you the size and scope and scale of this is really a first from the context of the loss of structures.
And because of the nonstop nature that you just painted and the size and scope of this wildfire, how are your workers doing? With a tragedy of this scale, I imagine the day-to-day stresses begin to take a toll.
Yeah, I can't express enough how proud I am of the team here and all of the responders. This is a one team, one fight, everybody is just committed. It's not just OES, it's all of the state agencies and departments, it's our partners at the federal level. It's an all hands on deck effort. Everybody's got to come to the table. But look, I can't tell you, I think everybody who's here and works at OES either knew somebody or had a family member or relative that was associated with Paradise. Mm-hmm. and including myself. It's an intense effort. The team is tired. We have been going for a long period of time. They're battle tested, but they're also
ready.
They're, you know, wiped out, I guess.
Oh, I see what you say. Yeah.
You know, they're battle weary, I guess is the word I was looking for. But they're at it, and they're going to continue to be at it. Now we're transitioning. The fire has been contained. That firefighting piece has come to a close, and now we're shifting resources to focus on the recovery. And in, you know, this case, you know, losing an entire town, losing all of your commercial, your tax base, there is no place to go. Even if we wanted to clear a lot and put a travel trailer or a fifth wheel or a mobile home on a piece of property, you can't do that in this case because there is no infrastructure to support it. Your water systems, there's no commercial sector, there's no medical facilities. So all of that needs to be addressed. So basically we're having to work very carefully with the cities of Chico and Gridley and Orrville, our surrounding communities to Paradise, to try to get them. They all have to, you know, in essence, it's become their disaster as well. And so, you know, collectively, we're all having to work through this. And of course, you know, these disasters, they know no boundaries, and they happen at holidays, so Thanksgiving and Christmas. And, you know, it's just a tough time for everybody. But, our folks are are working at it, and I'm proud of them, and I'm proud of all of the effort that a tremendous outpouring of interest and support for these folks up there.
Are there services available for PTSD-like symptoms, both for the victims of the wildfire and then, you know, your crew and people that have those secondary experiences with it?
Yeah, there are. In fact, we have at the Disaster Recovery Center, which is in right downtown Chico, there is a very significant group of mental health workers and folks that specialize in post-traumatic stress disorder. There's an area for children to be able to express themselves and work through that. There's efforts for adults and then seniors as well. As you probably know, there was a large senior population lived in Paradise, and so that's a focal group that we're really trying to work on. And then here at the State Operations Center and in our forward base camp, which is up in Chico, we actually have PTSD teams that are here and working with our crew, and we've got the dog teams to come through, and we encourage our folks to make sure they take the time. We're trying to make sure we flex everybody's time so that they can be there with their family as much as possible. But we had a team had to work through Thanksgiving. They're going to have to work through Christmas, and so we try to balance that out. This Thanksgiving we had a nice meal here. We invited all the families to come and be in the building with the workers as they were doing their job. So those are the kind of things we try to do to make it a little easier.
Finally, Mark, there's a lot of volunteer and charity efforts going on, but the bulk of what you do requires funding. And I'm wondering, will state and federal monies be there for your office to properly take care of the victims of this fire as we move, into weeks, months, years?
Well, I'm pretty confident we're going to be good. The state, the Governor Brown and our Department of Finance, and of course our legislature have been very supportive and wrap around this, and they've leaned very forward. I know the incoming administration, we've met with them as well, very supportive on what the needs are going to be. I will tell you, in this 3-week period, while we're still fighting the fire and dealing with the search operations, we were able to effectively and rapidly obtain that federal major disaster declaration. In fact, we were able to get the president to come out. It was one of the first times to see for himself what is going on, and there's been a tremendous amount of interest, and we've just yesterday moved forward with a federal appropriations request letter that will identify sums of money that can come back into the state that we can use for this disaster. And I'm pretty confident that we'll get the funds that we need. And if there's a problem with that, I'm very confident that people will hear from me about it.
Right. Well, Mark, thank you for sharing the status of your efforts now 3 week in. That's OES Director Mark Gilarducci with the latest on Camp Wildfire recovery efforts. Thanks so much for being on Insight this morning.
Great. Thank you, guys. Have a good day.
And we do have more on our website at capradio.org/insight. You can also go directly to capradio.org/wildfire or wildfires. They both work for the very latest on the campfire and other fire efforts around the state. You are listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. You are listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm Randall White in for Beth Ruyak today. Back on election night, the Associated Press called a Central Valley congressional race for its Republican incumbent. All signs pointed to the near certainty that Congressman David Valadao would hold on to his 21st district seat. But as vote totals continued to trickle in over the past few weeks, they favored his Democratic challenger. Now it appears to be a flipped seat. Joining us with more on this race is Cap Radio's Sally Schilling, who produces and reports for our Keys to the House podcast. So fun to have you on Insight, Sally.
Thanks, Randall.
Yeah, so Let's describe the district first. It is the 21st Congressional District, and it's pretty rural.
Yeah, so the 21st Congressional District runs from Fresno area down to Bakersfield. Doesn't include those towns, but a lot of small farm towns like Mendota, and along I-5, more to the west side of I-5.
And for anyone who's driven that, you don't see a lot of urban activity in those areas, which in California tends to lean Republican.
Right. And this district, has been traditionally very red, elected a Republican to Congress for decades, but did vote for Hillary Clinton in 2016. So it became this seat that Democrats eyed this time around as, hey, maybe we can flip this seat.
One of those targeted seats, but I think few people thought this one would actually flip.
This one was the least likely going into election day that political prognosticators thought would actually flip.
Yeah. And TJ Cox, after the latest count numbers that came in yesterday on Wednesday, TJ Cox made an announcement.
Yeah, he declared victory yesterday. So earlier in the week, we saw that he nudged ahead of Republican David Valadao by over 400 votes. And then another vote count came in and he nudged ahead by another about 70 votes and decided to declare victory.
And we should mention that a lot of news outlets are reporting that he's won, but the AP has, now they're being extremely cautious because officially, on election night, they called it for Valadao, but it has not yet been officially called. And here at Capital Public Radio, we use the AP as our source for whether a race has been called.
Right. So the AP will put a little check mark next to someone they've declared that, they've won that race, and they removed that little check mark earlier this week and have said, we're not going to officially, put that little check back there until the counties have all submitted their certified votes to the state. And that deadline is next Friday, December 7th.
So they're being shy.
Yeah. Yeah.
and rightfully so. They didn't get much wrong this election period, but they did on that one.
Right.
Call it incorrectly. And so they when they crunch the numbers on this sort of thing, how do they figure out who they're going to call before all the votes are in?
Yeah, so I was talking with our digital editor, Chris Hagan, about this. How often does this happen? How do they make this calculus when obviously still the vote can be switched? So I reached out to the AP and was trying to get some more information about their calculus. During election season, they've got reporters all over the country and they're submitting results to these different offices and having editors review that. They're looking at exit polls. They're looking at trends in voting in those specific districts and have this sort of vague calculus to my understanding right now. I'm curious to learn more about it. But looking at the history, looking at registered voter numbers, exit polls, and with Valadao's seat, their calculus said, hey, he's got this in the bag, but...
But so what happened in the remaining weeks, the votes coming in, they didn't just skew Democratic. They really switched.
Yeah. So in Keys to the House, we've talked to some political analysts about what happens after election night, and heard that vote counts as the later votes are counted tend to skew Democrat in California. So you have these the earlier votes that are coming in by mail, even earlier at the polls, tend to be wealthier, property owning, likely conservative voters. So those votes came in earlier. And then those provisional ballots, those people bringing their vote by mail ballot to their polling place last minute on election night, those tend to be younger renters who tend to vote more liberal. And so we're used to seeing these later votes start to skew Democratic, but, by a few percentage points. And in Valadao's, that was a seven percentage point swing.
Wow.
Yeah. So that was a lot bigger.
And it's not the only race where the Republican incumbent was ahead on election night. Here in our listening area, in the Modesto area, we had Jeff Denham's seat. He was ahead on election night.
He was ahead, and he was ahead by about, it was close. This one was not called right away. It was called like a week after. But Denham was ahead by about 1,000 votes. And then Democrat Josh Harder, who was challenging incumbent Jeff Denham, ended up coming back with an 8,000 vote advantage and won the race. And so actually Jeff Denham, he's been talking to media, raising questions about the election process in California.
We've had six different election laws changed in the last 6 years, four of which happened this election. When you've got six out of those seven congressional seats that were targeted, six of them were ahead on election night, election day voters. Six of them were ahead on absentee. Six of them were ahead on early voting. So I think the question needs to come back is this new election law. First of all, what do these provisionals say about our overall election and changing? I mean, statistically impossible to have six seats that won all the early voting, including election day, to see the provisionals, the set-aside ballots, come in after the fact. And in this case, the 21st district, 2 weeks late. I mean, the question needs to be not only to the Republican Party in California on the rules, but I think the state as a whole needs to look at the provisional ballots.
So that was Jeff Denham speaking earlier this week on MSNBC, and he's kind of questioning, you know, this big swing that we're seeing so late in the game. And I think he's alluding to some of California's new voting rules, including conditional voting, which is same day registration. You go to the poll, you register, and then submit your vote. So things like that, where we're getting a lot more late ballots. But these are all legal rules we have in place for our voting system now. But you see this on both sides at the end of the election saying, you know, putting into question the voting process, conveniently, you know, when they didn't win the race.
I mean, in the state of Georgia, we had an opposite situation where the Republican won for governor and the Democratic challenger was saying that voter suppression, the opposite side of it, skewed things Republican.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And so and that tends to be the trend when you restrict voting on many levels. It tends to skew conservative. When you open it up so as many people as possible can vote, it tends to skew more liberal. And we're seeing that here in California. And at least in this case, somebody speaking out saying they're not happy with it. Joining us right now is Cap Radio's Sally Schilling, who produces and reports for our Keys to the House podcast. You were down in Orange County where many of these potentially flippable seats are located. All of them have flipped.
All of them have flipped. And then if Valadao's seat has flipped too, then we're seeing that all seven California districts that were held by Republicans that Democrats were eyeing because they went for Hillary Clinton were flipped.
And then that would bring the number of seats nationally flipped by the Democrats to 40 or 41?
40, if we count
T.J. Cox.
T.J. Cox.
Uh-huh. What does that do for the lawmaking process, in Washington, in the Capitol building?
So I've talked to congressional Democrats, including Ted Lieu, who told me earlier this year that, you know, if we do get a majority back in the House, you know, we're going to be leading some of these key committees in the House that can investigate the president. We'll have subpoena power. We can look into the president's tax returns. So I think we will see, in a lot of ways, some stalemates on presidential policies in the House. But meanwhile, you know, it's important to remember that Republicans did gain 2 seats in the Senate. So on the other hand, things like judicial confirmations will probably be more favorable to the presidency in the next 2 years. But it's interesting looking at, you know, a House that is controlled by Democrats now. Some political writers are saying, hey, you know, this could be good for President Trump in the next 2 years because he's going to have this very visible adversary, right?
And he's been supporting the election of Nancy Pelosi as Speaker, saying even at one point that he would bring in Republicans to make it happen. What's the calculus behind that?
Yeah, I think he thinks that could be a great adversary for him in the public eye. And maybe going into 2020, you know, he'll have this battle going on that really mobilizes his base going into 2020.
So Keys to the House was a key podcast heading into the elections, but you're not finished with it and you're still working on more. What's coming up next?
So next week we will have our final episode and obviously lots of discussion about this Congressional District 21 and what's happened there, and just recapping everything and what this means. Did we see a blue wave? We'll have some analysts on talking with our Capitol Bureau Chief Ben Adler. So it'll be a fun wrap. I mean, it was an exciting election in terms of these congressional races in California.
Yeah, so a bit of a preview of the final Keys to the House episode with Cap Radio's Sally Schilling. She produces that podcast and also reports on it. Thanks so much for being on Insight, Sally.
Thanks, Randall.
It's fun to have you here. We have more on our website at capradio.org/insight. You can also go /keys for the Keys to the House podcast. This is Insight on your public radio station, Cap Radio. You are listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm Randall White in today for Beth Ruyak. You know, despite a severe housing crisis that's facing the entire state of California, residents of the Sacramento region are pretty evenly split on whether new housing should even be built. That's just one finding in a new livability study completed by Valley Vision and Sacramento State's Institute for Social Research. Joining us today is Valley Vision CEO Bill Mueller. Welcome to Insight.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Also here to help us understand the survey results is Valley Vision's research editor, Evan Schmidt. Thank you for being on Insight.
Thank you.
And before we start breaking down how residents feel about living in the Sacramento area, because mm-hmm. that's what the survey is about, right?
Mm-hmm. It is.
Can you, Bill, quickly explain what Valley Vision does, just so we can understand why this survey is important?
Sure. So Valley Vision's job in the region is to help transform people's lives by bringing us together to solve our biggest challenges, our biggest economic, social, and environmental challenges. We've been around for about 25 years, and we have board members that come from area universities, hospitals, businesses, and foundations. It's sort of the region's table. It's a place where people can come. They can get really good information, like this public opinion poll, because we know that oftentimes when we're trying to figure out a way forward, we need facts and evidence. And so one of the ways that Valley Vision helps our elected officials is that we provide those facts and evidence, and then really capable staff members that help project manage those particular projects, whether it's affordable housing projects or helping people access the food that they need, or even imagining how we can grow jobs here. Often leaders will turn to Valley Vision to help them out.
And are these surveys done annually?
This is the third in a series. We do 2 to 3 of these surveys a year. We've studied transportation. We've studied civic amenities. But this is the first poll and our most important poll, because we're asking the big questions about how people like living in the greater Sacramento area. So we ask questions about how welcome they feel, whether this is an inclusive community, whether they have pride in their community, and then very basic things like, do they have access to health care? Do they favor the education choices do they have? Do they have access to jobs? Do they feel good about their community overall? And so we have those insights.
And Evan, how is the research collected? How do we make this a nice, clean study?
Yeah, so working with the Institute for Social Research at Sac State, this is a survey that goes out to the same, each survey goes out to the same panel of people. That's about 2,000 people, and they have the option of taking it throughout the year. And so and for this survey, we have 960 people that have taken the survey throughout an 8-county region. And we get they take it online. And then working with the Institute for Social Research, we analyze those results and come to these findings.
How are those 2,000 people chosen?
They cast postcards out to 30,000 people or more in order to get volunteers who are willing to participate.
If just a fraction of the participants fill out the survey, is there a point at which you say, you know, really only this spectrum of people replied, so we don't think it's valid?
No, this is a scientifically valid survey. Mm-hmm. And so the Institute for Social Research really works to make sure the demographic categories of the participants are weighted to represent the overall population of the region.
All right. So now let's crack some of these numbers that came out with this latest survey. And California, as I mentioned, is in the midst of a housing shortage. Many people cite a shortage of housing as a problem. What does it mean for the region that nearly half of the respondents are right at half, I guess statistically half of the respondents to the survey don't want to see any housing built?
Well, this is probably one of the foundational concerns that we have is that on the one hand, the survey shows that building affordable housing is one of the most important priorities that the survey uncovered, that residents are really want affordable housing and they need it. They expect government to help us build it and provide it together with our building and the private sector markets. Yet at the same time, we're at a bit of a crossroads, whether or not we want to see more houses built or whether we just want to sort of keep the greater Sacramento area the same. And so it literally came down to 49-51. So as even a split as you could possibly imagine between those that want to embrace the boom that's happening in the greater Sacramento area and those that want to keep things the same. So it's a bit of a conundrum, and frankly, it's an area that we want to explore further with experts in housing and in government and within the community to unlock the findings more so that we can sort of find a path forward.
Yeah, because my next question, Evan, was were you able to drill down to the why? Why someone says, no, I don't want more housing, or why someone wants to get behind, expanding housing options in the Sacramento region?
Right. Well, first, I think that even though there was a lot of division around kind of the vision for the future, there was a lot of consensus around what the actual problems are. And so, you know, talking about that we need affordable housing, that was very clear. 75% of the people agreed with that. Where we want local governments to make investments, that was also really clear that affordable housing is really important there. When you dig into the subpopulations and what they think about both the growth question and what some of those major issues are, for example, we saw that people 18 to 34 were most likely to want housing development to speed up and were most, in terms of local government investments, affordable housing was the most important thing for them. Same with renters. And those are the same populations that are the most mobile in the region, meaning they have recently moved in the last 3 years and plan to move again in the next 3 years. So I don't know if it gets all the way down to the why question, but it does kind of give some insights into who needs more affordable housing and how we should approach that.
Was there a barometer for infill versus sprawl?
One way I would answer that is that we don't have that information yet, but we're going to. So one of the ways in which we intend to follow up on this research is pull the data apart even more, because in the research, we know how people responded if they lived in the city, in suburbs, or out in rural. We also know and have the ability to pull the data apart on people who make less than $50,000 or people who make more than $50,000. We also have the ability to look at ways in which people who are African-American or Latino or white and whether their views split on this issue. So we haven't gone so far as to analyze those things, but we will be over the coming weeks, and we look forward to coming back and talking to you about what we find.
Mm-hmm. Evan?
We also ask questions about their preferences, both in the suburban and city environment, whether they would like a mix of offices and retail with houses or residential only. And we got a pretty strong response that the mix of offices, retail, and housing is the people's top priority. That's the type of environment they want to live in. So to me, that really indicates more mixed use and right. more infill than it would sprawl. And
more walkable cities.
Exactly.
Uh-huh. We are speaking with Valley Vision's CEO, Bill Mueller, and the organization's research director, Evan Schmidt, about the results of a new livability study for the Sacramento region and now what I consider to be like the more fun part of the study. What do people think about living here? Like, you know, do we enjoy Sacramento?
We love Sacramento. So one of the overriding responses, nearly 80% of respondents in the Sacramento region report that they're satisfied with their quality of life.
8 out of 10 people.
8 out of 10 people. And what's amazing in that is that if you've been in the Sacramento region for 15 or 20 years, we've had a confidence problem. Sometimes we haven't sort of really embraced the fact that we love the greater Sacramento area, that we love the universities, we love the trees, the river, recreational assets, that we have places like the Crocker or the downtown sports arena, and that it's easy to come and go. We really haven't embraced that. But what this study shows is that we've overcome that confidence problem. But here's the challenge. When the community begins to take more pride in ownership, they're also willing to look at some of the things that aren't quite right. So that's the other thing that is coming through, is that with pride comes, well, I want my community to be better. And maybe the community is a little bit more willing to address the things that they want to improve. And that is also very clearly here. There are some challenges that we have that our research uncovered.
And what are those challenges that rose to the surface with this?
Well, one of the key issues is that everyone is gripped by the fact that not enough people have housing that they can afford. And the homeless problem in the Sacramento region is one of the top rated issues that people are recognizing and that they want to see addressed. And we see it all across the Sacramento region.
Okay. And quickly, Evan, are there any surprising trends that came up?
Well, one thing that was really great about this survey is that we had 3 open-ended questions that people could just write in their thoughts and perspectives. And so we asked them what sets the region apart, what do they love about the region, and what are the most pressing regional problems. And we were able to really detail a lot of those rich thoughts that people had. One thing that's been really consistent throughout all our polls is people's love of nature's parks, trails in the region. That was strong in this survey. It's been strong in other surveys as well. I think the strength to which people had strong feelings about homelessness, affordable housing, and rent, as Bill has already mentioned, that came out very strongly as well. But I think the rich quotes that we got from those open-ended questions, which are detailed in our full report, are one of the gems of this survey.
And we'll offer that report up, of course, at capradio.org/insight. That's Valley Vision's CEO, or I'm sorry, who you just heard from is the organization's research director. We also heard from Valley Vision's CEO, Bill Mueller. Thank you both for being on Insight today.
Thank you for having
us.
And as I mentioned, we have more on our website at capradio.org/insight. You are listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm Randall White in for Beth Ruyak today. And it is post-Thanksgiving, but not yet December. Is it okay to start playing Christmas music? Not according to Cap Radio's Hey Listen host, Nick Bruner. He's joining us now with his new music picks for the week's Sound Advice segment. Fun to have you here on Insight, Nick.
Hey, Randall. Thanks for having me.
So you are definitely No Christmas music before December 1.
Well, here's the thing. I started listening to some, I got a couple Christmas records in from some artists that I play, and I put one on about 2 days ago, and I just went, I can't do it yet. I can't yet. But, I mean, I am one of those people who once December 1st kicks in, I'm like, all right, let's do this. Boom. Yeah. And sleigh ride.
The
all
lights
day.
Are starting to pop up in the neighborhoods and stuff, so I'm easing into it as well.
I'm ready for it. It's post Thanksgiving, so I'm kind of like, yeah. But there's so much good stuff to get to before that I couldn't just dwell on December theme music yet. So I'd like to start with this group called the Glands that I absolutely love. This Athens, Georgia indie rock group started back in the late '90s. They put out a couple of records, but were really like just bubbling under the surface. Didn't get a lot of international attention, and had been just almost completely silent since about 2002. So I was really surprised to see this album come out that's 23 tracks long, and it just kind of hit me like a bolt out of the blue. I thought, wow, that someone else using the name The Glands? But no, not at all. This is a track that I just love off it. The album's called Double Coda. This is Great Waves.
Hey, Mom, what's the matter with me? You don't love me.
And their big music scene there that has a like Bob Dylan-ish stuff sound to it.
That's the vocal qualities of Ross Shapiro. Another reason that I was surprised that this album was released when it did was because that Ross had passed away in 2016. So this is just the sort of last hurrah for the band, The Glands.
And they had pre-recorded some of those songs, I guess.
Absolutely.
All right, next up is La 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 La.
That's the that's the songwriting name of Chicago songwriter Lily West. She just released her follow-up to her debut record from 2016. This is called Spy.
That sound.
It's kind of got this sort of kind of like a slow, beachy kind of vibe to it, right?
Smashing Pumpkins kind of had that a little bit too.
Smashing Pumpkins, now that you mention it, did have a track or two here that
also
would do
Chicago
that.
Based.
Also Chicago based, absolutely. Lily West, not nearly as nuts as Billy Corgan.
No.
which I appreciate these days.
The group Cloud Nothings?
Yes. This starts as a lamentation of the definition of the term emo, Randall White. Back when I was in college, here's where the old man starts kicking in. Emo meant like, I look out now and I see people like making fun of people dressed up like Robert Smith and be like, emo. I'm like, no, that's goth. Emo used to at least sound like this.
Jen Picard and Anthony Van Hook are dancing in the control booth. They like that.
Yes, I can see that. They have frowns on their faces, right? When they do that? Yes. That's because it's an emo song you just heard.
That was called Leave Him Now?
Yes, yes. I really like that track because it sounds like there's like it sounds like the singer Dylan Baldy is really just lamenting a friend being in the middle of a toxic relationship and just really wants the best for whoever he's singing at. And I don't know. There's something about that track really just gets me.
And if you thought that was miserable, the next track really is.
Wow. Look at you. That is a transition. You should have just played the song. Yes, the next band is Miserable. It's the solo project from Christina Esfandiari, who got her start making music here in Sacramento. She fronts a band called King Woman, and Miserable is sort of, as she told me a while back, more of like a grungy, angsty, different part of her that King Woman doesn't do. So this is her solo, her newest EP came out just about 2 or 3 weeks ago. It's called Lover Boy, Dog Days, and from that, this is a track called High.
Thank you.
time for one last one. And this last one was recorded
right here at Capital Public Radio. Skylar Peterson, he makes music under the name Make Belief.
Was recorded here?
Yeah, but you know, mostly he did all the heavy lifting. Like yeah. he brought in all of his equipment and all the way that he amplifies his voice and the samples that he plays. He just him singing, had a couple laptops and a cymbal that he was whacking on. It's great. I'm going to be playing that on Hey Listen this weekend.
Awesome. They can hear it all. Cap Radio's Hey Listen host Nick Bruner with his sound advice picks for the week. Awesome to have you here.
Thanks, Randall.
That last song, I can hear it playing at our house. All right, that's Insight for today. I'm Randall White, working to fill the big shoes of Beth Ruyak. Insight is produced by Jen Picard, Bert Johnson, and Cody Drabble. Our digital team, Chris Hagen, Casey Gardner, and Emily Zentner. Our technical director, Mark Jones. Today's engineer is Anthony Van Hook. Insight's executive producer is Joe Barr. And we're back with Insight Music tomorrow. Thanks for joining us. I cannot see.